Beautiful blooms and edible gardens have been sprouting in Kentucky for weeks now, a sure sign that spring has sprung. On this week's Eastern Standard, we'll talk about gardens and growing things. We have guests with green thumbs around the table to respond to your questions, your comments, your personal stories, or even suggestions. Send us an email right now to wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can send a tweet at WEKUEST, post on the WEKU website or Facebook page, and in just a few minutes, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard as we talk about gardening and growing things, both vegetable gardens as well as flowers, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen. And this week we've gathered a group of guests around our table, and actually one is on the phone line who can help us with our growing concerns at this time of the year. We have with us in the studio Alexis Amaries, who is Boyle County agent for Horticulture, Horticulture education. Actually, you're an extension agent.
Yes, that's correct.
And also another extension agent, Adam Leonberger. Mm-hmm. And Adam is with UK Cooperative Extension Service for Franklin County, extension agent for horticulture. Both of you, horticulture meaning we're dealing with plants, growing things.
Yeah, exactly. If you can grow it, we can help you with it.
Excellent. And we also want to welcome to our program on the phone line, Ryan Cook of Seedleaf. Am I saying your name correctly, Ryan?
That's right.
Okay.
Great.
Excellent. Ryan, you are director of the Lexington-based organization Seedleaf. And before I ask Alexis and Adam to tell me what they do, tell me about Seedleaf. What is Seedleaf?
Yeah, our mission is to nourish communities by growing and sharing food. And so we're cultivating 15 free U-Pick spaces throughout the north side of Lexington where food access is a real problem. And we're trying to have spaces where people can harvest what they recognize and what they can use at home.
Growing and sharing food, that's the mission mm-hmm. of Seedleaf, and we'll talk with Ryan about that. Let me ask Alexis and Adam as extension agents. Now, some of us who are of a certain age may remember the 1960s TV show Green Acres. It seems to me that was the one show that had a prominent extension agent in it, and it seems to me even folks of your age have heard of Mr. Haney on that program. Is that what you guys do? You go around visiting farmers and helping people out with stuff?
That's part of what we do. We help out farmers and growers, but also being horticulture agents, we help homeowners with their problems as well.
Yeah, we get a big list of things that come in. So we get trees and shrubs, flowers. We have our big commercial growers that are going to be doing vegetable fruit production. You know, we deal with wineries. I've even had hops growers come in. But just earlier today, I had somebody give me a call and say, something's wrong with my tomato plants. And, you know, we go through those and help walk them through what's going on.
Explain to me the reason. Why do universities like UK have extension agents? What is this whole concept about? I mean, extension sounds like you're extending the mission of the university out into the community somehow?
Absolutely. So Kentucky State University, along with the University of Kentucky, are land-grant universities, basically meaning they do a lot of research. That research needs to go out to the community. It needs to go out to our farmers. And we are the middleman who takes that really scientific jargon and we bring that down and say, this is actually how you practically use this jargon and help our farmers with, you know, new pesticides, new growing techniques, things along those lines.
And we see out when we drive up I-75, we'll see like UK agriculture. Was that, is it a test farm, a trial farm? Tell me about that.
Well, that's I believe the Spindletop and Main Chance mm-hmm. Farms. That's one of the many agriculture research farms that they go through, and their UK is trying to help solve a lot of the practical problems that farmers and growers see across the state. Trying to solve those issues, or trying to scout out possible different avenues for farmers to take to help diversify.
So again, research that's going on behind the scenes, mm-hmm. Academicians, folks who are scientists, I guess,
yes,
mm-hmm. and making it practical. Are you guys scientists?
We like to think so, right?
Yeah.
They gave me a degree and said it was in science, so
excellent.
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually have a degree in a master's in science for plant pathology, trained in plant disease diagnostics. So,
excellent. And on this week's show, we are going to encourage our listeners to call in with questions about growing things. This time of the year, we know it is officially spring and has been officially spring for over a month. But I know I've always heard that old saying that you may not want to plant certain things until after Mother's Day. So we're a couple of weeks away from Mother's Day, and we'll talk about that, if that's still a meaningful concept, and what could go in the ground now, and what is best to wait a little bit longer. Let me turn back to Ryan Cook with Seedleaf. And again, Ryan, you're, as opposed to the extension of services from a university into the community, Seedleaf has a mission, or it's kind of an agenda, I guess.
Yeah, so I feel like our work dovetails a lot, and we're friendly with our extension agents here in Fayette County, and we're doing a whole lot to try to encourage neighbors to grow just something on the home scale. If you want to just get started planting, you know, basil in a pot and have that by the window, I mean, that's kind of what started to turn my head about gardening some years ago, but we're just trying to encourage people and make it fun too. We offer a lot of worm shops and show people how to compost at home, food waste.
Did you say worms?
That's right. Yeah. That's something that makes sense for people living in apartments. They might not be able to have a compost pile, but they might use worms to work on their banana peels and coffee grounds. And then, you know, when those worms do their work, they're creating a really great soil amendment that we can put right on our gardens.
So how do people access the services of Seedleaf? Do you you go around giving educational talks and presentations? Do you have a storefront, or do you have community supported agriculture gardens, farmers garden activities?
We don't do a farmers market at this point. We do our best education when people can get in a row with us, and we can do weed identification. Here's the pepper plant, here's the pigweed, and we do a lot of hands-on. Our volunteers always show up at any of our gardens, and they can learn as they're keeping that garden with us. So we do a lot of experiential education. We're just convinced that's what helps people of all ages learn and retain that knowledge. We will do, in the colder months, we might do a road show and do some talks and kind of cultivate interest among our potential volunteers with the spring in mind. But this is the season where a lot of the stuff we're doing is outside, and we've got several Get in the Garden events through the week where people can just come and help us care for that garden and learn along the way.
Our listeners to this program, of course, many of them are in the Lexington area. Many of them are in other cities or urban communities. Of course, many people in rural areas or in the suburban areas. We want to encourage folks from no matter where you happen to be part of this week's Eastern Standard. If you have a question, a comment, a personal story about gardening, about growing things, we can talk about vegetable gardens as well as flowering gardens, I guess.
Trees,
bushes, landscaping issues, I suspect. So feel free to participate in the show with an email, wekueastern.standard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST, and we will go ahead and open up the phone lines, 800-621-8890. If you have a question, a comment, a personal story, a suggestion, or a tip, I'm quite curious about folks who might live maybe in say one of the high-rise apartment buildings in downtown Lexington. What can folks living in those circumstances do to participate in growing things beyond, the occasional potted plant? So please feel free to call in with whatever you want to share with us or questions you would like to have answered as we talk about gardening and growing things. Kind of a lighthearted program today, not likely to go anyplace terribly political or very theoretical, but we can go there if you would like to do that as well. 800-621-8890, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. gmail.com. Let me turn back to our extension agents. What kind of things do you guys deal with on a daily basis?
Well, it's pretty time of the year dependent, but I'd say moles are one of my biggest questions. So this mole is terrorizing my lawn. What do I do about it? And Adam has a fun way that he tells people how to deal with them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of great ways that people want to try different things. I get them calls all the time. You know, they've tried bubble gum and hair down the holes.
Mothballs
and sonic devices. And unfortunately, they just really don't work that well. So the best effective way is actually just the trapping. So using something like a simple harpoon trap or the scissor traps you get from Tractor Supply, Home Depot, Lowe's. Really, that's the most effective route. I really advise against doing things like the poison baits, just because, it's an opportunity for other animals to get non-target animals to get poisoned, or if those moles do get poisoned, then they now have a toxic carcass that a pet could get into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the also good thing about that is that moles are very territorial, so you usually only have about one per acre. So if you can get rid of one, you're typically good to go. So that's always a positive thing I like to tell my homeowners. It just take once.
Yeah.
So we're focusing on growing things and gardening, so critters sometimes tend to have an impact on growing.
Yes, absolutely. Moles and voles. I mean, we get a lot
chipmunks.
Of insect questions. Yeah, chipmunks, squirrels are, digging up my bulbs and moving them.
Rabbits in gardens, I guess?
Rabbits in gardens, yeah.
Deer?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, the deer question. Yeah. How do I get rid of deer? Well, do you live in city limits is usually my question. And people ask me why. And I said, well, you could shoot them. So there's that option. At least out in Boyle County, we've got some nice rural areas. So that is an option for some of our gardeners, our big gardeners especially.
And Ryan Cook, who's on the line with us of Seedleaf in Lexington. I know you've been on the program before. We're talking about sustainability issues. Where does that come into play when we talk about gardening and growing things? I mean, so many of us are dependent on the big stores, the supermarkets, companies that make large amount of profit off of the foods that they sell to us, whether it's produce or meat or canned and processed foods. What are the big issues that you all are focusing on in that area?
Oh, the big focus has to do with access and then helping people grow their own stuff. Whenever my neighbors here in North Lexington, it's easy to get to a shop that might sell quite a bit of alcohol and highly processed food. Fast food is well represented throughout the central sector of Lexington. But to get to a proper grocery store with a section to have access to greens and fresh fruits and vegetables, that's going to take, for a lot of my neighbors, at least one bus ride, maybe a transfer. And so there's these barriers to healthy food, and they have real life health consequences. And so some of the sustainability issues we're trying to work out is how to help especially young people, but neighbors of any age, get out, get a little activity, help with the garden, do some weeding and watering, and hopefully meet their neighbors and take home some fresh food that they can share at home.
Okay, very much a springtime topic. On the line with us is Ryan Cook with Seedleaf. We have with us Adam Leonberger and Alexis Amaris. They are extension agents, and we're interested in your questions, your comments, your stories, your suggestions as we talk about gardening and growing things on this week's Eastern Standard, WEKU Eastern Standard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKU EST, 800-621-8890.
Inch by inch, row by row, I'm gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rain come tumbling down.
Is that all it takes? A rake and a hoe and a patch of fertile ground?
And a little bit of determination, I think.
A little bit of determination? Okay, we're talking gardening and growing things on this week's Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsburg, and with me in the studio are Alexis Amaris and Adam Leonberger. They are extension agents. And Ryan Cook of Seedleaf in Lexington, and they're here to answer your questions about growing things and related issues. Please feel free to join in by calling 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. Usually, we do talk about issues on this program. We're likely to talk about current events. We may talk about politics and major world events and concerns. It's springtime, time to lighten up a little bit, especially after the year that we have had with in politics and the change in presidential administrations and so forth. So let's talk about something that most everybody can agree on. Most everybody, I think, should be able to agree on a good-tasting tomato plant. Or good the tomato itself, not the plant. Personally, I go in to, you know, order a sandwich at one of the restaurants where they put the thing together for you, and I always turn down the tomatoes because they're gross. Tell me, folks, about how I can get a decent tasting tomato. I mean, in all seriousness, it's like, why do I even want a? Even if it's a nice, beautiful hamburger, do we like a tomato on that? Are these fresh? You know, are they
local?
Yeah, are they local? And it's like most of the time, there's not even any taste to a tomato.
Mm-hmm. And a big issue, I have a hard time finding myself, especially during the winter, finding anything that's worth tasting. It's hard to, you know, a lot of those ones in the winter are being grown in hothouses up in Canada, Michigan, or out of Mexico. And it's hard to replicate that same the good environment you get in the backyard.
What's the problem? Are they picked before their time, and it takes so long for them to get here?
Well, a little bit of everything. When you're talking winter-grown tomatoes, you're talking everything's artificial. So, you know, a lot of sunlight can be artificial. You know, they've got grow lights on them in some cases. And then, you know, some of those are grown hydroponically, and meaning that there's not necessarily those same wonderful soil microbes and soil aspects that we love that grow our good tomatoes. So they're giving the plant exactly what it needs to grow, but that doesn't mean it's exactly what it needs to taste good. So,
what are your gripes? Let me ask you this, Alexis, Adam, and Ryan, your gripes about food that you may get, even when you go to places that, you know, that are intended to be a fresh deli, where you're going to put together a nice meal for yourself, or at least a sandwich, and there's some things that just don't satisfy because of the way we treat our food. Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, one gripe is when restaurants want to tell you that this is a local thing, and then they have not gone ahead and sourced locally. They're trying to make hay on that trend, and that's just not fair for our farmers. So that's one thing I've caught myself being crabby about.
How can you trust a restaurant? I mean, when they tell you that what they bring is locally sourced.
Yeah,
I mean,
I kind of had an inside. My server let me know. She steered me away from that. So
I think I've seen a lot as part of the trend of that local food movement, which is a wonderful trend and hopefully not a trend that leaves us, is that people are proud to say where it's from. It's not, it's local, or, I bought it from Kentucky. It's, I bought it from this farm, from this person. You know, even they'll tell you the date that they bought it on. But, you know, you can usually trust a place that'll tell you, the tomatoes are from so-and-so's farm. You know, the meat is from so-and-so's farm. And so I think that's a good way to tell.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, that's usually what I look for as well. It's, the ones that I trust are going to be local. They have it listed, you know, a list of all their local producers on every single table or right next to the menu, so that way it's proudly displayed that they've gone out and sourced these things themselves, that, you know, they're the good quality that the local people are really selling at this point.
This is Eastern Standard, and we're going to go to the phone lines and interact with our listeners shortly after I ask another question or so that it's on my mind that I think is important to get through with. But and certainly Ben from Richmond, thank you for hanging on there. We'll get to you in just a moment. 800-621-8890. Let me toss that out there because we do have some lines open. 800-621-8890 or send an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. And I don't know if we have a tweet yet, but we do have at least one email and at least one phone call. Let me ask you all, again, Ryan, Adam, and Alexis, define for me a couple of terms. We hear this term organic, or we hear this term about natural foods. What do these terms mean in the real world, and especially what do they mean to us as the person who's likely to go shopping for produce, to cook at home, or even to order off of a restaurant menu?
So organic, I'll start with that one. That is a certification that's done through the USDA. OMRI is O-M-R-I. It's an acronym, and you're going to ask me right now what it stands for, and I couldn't tell you. I forget.
It's the Organic Material Registration Initiative, possibly.
Maybe.
We'll go initiative.
That sounds great. basically, you'll always hear it called OMRI, OMRI approved. It's an organic certification. And so that basically means that there is somebody out at these farms checking to make sure these treatments for these plants are organic. All your fertilizers are going to be from naturally derived sources. All of your washing techniques, all of your herbicides, pesticides, all of these are going to be organic options. And it also means they've kept very good records. So our organic growers are diligent record keepers. They have to be to maintain and get a certification. That we can track exactly what happened to that tomato plant from seed all the way to your table.
As opposed to the major corporate growing firms that provide to supermarkets that we may not be able to track that?
Well, there's organic options in that route, too. I mean, we have organic commercial growers in California, and, we have organic, fruit operations. And yeah.
And they're every the same size as some of the large conventional mm-hmm. growers as well.
Mm-hmm. So organic doesn't necessarily mean small. We have plenty of great small growers that, focus on integrated pest management and keeping, sustainability, but they're not necessarily certified. It does cost to become a certified organic farmer. So some of our farmers do pretty much everything organic, but they can't afford the certification.
Yeah. And one of the things I like to mention to people is the local farmers, they're on tight profit margins anyhow. Mm-hmm. So they're not spraying just because they want to or just because they think it might be good. They're only spraying when they have to, just to control certain things.
Right. And spraying an organic doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe. So there are plenty of organic pesticides that are, dangerous and have certain things that, you have to wear, a mask, or you have to wear the same things that you would have to wear if you were using commercial. So, organic is great, but, sustainability is best, at least in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Ryan. Why do organic oranges or potatoes or whatever I might pick up in the produce department at a supermarket mm-hmm. that generally has relatively low prices, why are the organic products so much more expensive than others?
I think we, as a culture, we went towards conventional stuff as a labor-saving concern generally. So whenever we're able to spray all those things, we might get better yield and there might be fewer farmers working on that, this or that crop. One of our, I think, Seedleaf's unfair advantages, we have so many volunteers coming through, and I also often use it as a teaching point that we can take the time to remove the things off the potatoes, the Colorado potato beetle, for example, or cabbage looper moth. I can show my volunteers, here's what this looks like. Let's pull these off by hand. Our Kentucky growers can't really afford to do that all Saturday morning.
This week's Eastern Standard is a program directed at our listeners, an opportunity for you to get some advice from folks with their green thumbs talking about growing things. 800-621-8890, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. As promised, and I'm sorry for keeping you waiting so long, Ben from Richmond, you are on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Glad to have you. What's on your mind?
I have a couple of questions. My farm is in the process of it's transitional to organic, so I just wanted to show my support for that. And OMRI stands for Organic Materials Review Institute.
Yes. But, thank you.
Anyhow, I've got some questions regarding apple cedar rust and what I can do about that. I have a lot of apple trees planted, and as I'm sure you're aware, Madison County, where I live in Richmond, is just covered in cedar. And from what I can tell, there's not really any organic or transitional options for me, aside from trying to cut down all my cedar, which would be a big task. But, I mean, beyond that, all my neighbors' properties are just covered in cedar as well. So is there something I'm missing?
First of all, tell me what cedar rust is.
Apple cedar rust is it's a fungal pathogen. It's a pathogen on both the eastern red cedar and apple trees, and it requires both hosts, and it only goes from the cedars to the apples, and from the apples it has to go back to cedars, and it will on the cedars. Those are they'll form little hard wooden galls, and then in the spring those galls will kind of do orange jelly tendrils. And the cedars, it's a leaf spot. It's a yellow leaf spot with a bright red ring around it and can cause some defoliation on that. As far as how to control it organically, the biggest thing, first thing to really think about is doing culture controls, which is looking for resistant varieties. That's one of the major, our worst diseases, even for conventional growers. If you can, try to go with resistant apple varieties. And then look for getting those cedar trees as far out away from those trees as possible. Pruning the trees properly so you get good airflow going through it. That'll help dry out the leaves quicker so that those fungal spores don't have that moisture to germinate and grow on. You're right. There's not a lot of great organic chemical options there, but really the main thing with organic is you need to be focusing on those cultural controls first.
Yeah, there
are. And as far as, like, cleaning up the leaves in the fall, I'm doing all that. I just seem to have this problem every year.
Yeah. And the sanitation around it, because the apple cedar rust specifically has to go from the apples to the cedars back over, the sanitation from this disease isn't going to increase or decrease that disease specifically. You want to do the sanitation still for things like apple rust and
scab
and the bacterial, the fire blight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, preventative with it comes to organic. Your organic options for, you know, apples or vegetables, it's all going to be preventative. Once you have it, you got it. So we've got to focus on some of those preventative. Is there a preventative, Adam, to that or a semi? I mean, is copper going to be something?
Copper probably would have some efficacy. That's a fairly general overall biocide, fungicide but you're going to have to apply it almost weekly.
Right.
Every time it rains, you're going to have to reapply it again as well and get good coverage.
All right, Ben, I guess you had a question about honeysuckle as well, which I know is a persistent problem for many people.
Yeah, and it ties in with my transitional status as well. What should I do about slash and paint of all my honeysuckle? Because it's just like, it's rampant. I mean, I couldn't say I don't think I have a bigger problem on the farm.
It sounds like you are outside on the farm right now.
Do you want me to step inside?
If you can, that would be good. Then we'll need to move on anyway. But let's talk about the honeysuckle.
So honeysuckle, you're right. If you're doing transition, you're not really allowed to use Roundup too much. So that's not necessarily, the glyphosate is not going to be a good option for you. So as far as honeysuckle, that's going to be difficult. The biggest thing you're going to have to do is if you've got big overgrown honeysuckle, you need to wrap a chain around it, hook it to the back of your tractor, your truck, and you pull it out.
My goodness, that sounds like a big honeysuckle.
Yeah, the key with honeysuckle is going to be giving it something to compete against. And so, you know, if you're pulling out these honeysuckles, they're going to keep coming back. The birds are going to keep dropping the seed. So you've got to plant something else in there, whether that's, you know, a grass, something that's going to tolerate shade. If you're talking about the woods, if you're talking about other areas, you know, can you till? Can you crop there? Tillage is going to be a great thing for dealing with honeysuckle. I'm not an expert on organics, but I know that in some cases, if you are applying an herbicide, if you need to apply an herbicide and it's not to a part that you're going to crop in, they will allow it. So if this is in an area that you're not cropping in currently or not going to crop in currently, you know, you can use that painted on glyphosate. You know, you, in the fall, cut that honeysuckle back and just, you know, lightly dab on some of that glyphosate and it'll take it down into the root system. And I think that that is allowed under certain, like I said, certain areas of your farm, you're allowed to use it and still be organic and into an organic transition. So you'll want to talk to, you know, them about that and look that up.
Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's only other real good option is they're going to be continuously cutting it down and cutting it back and trying to wear down those energy reserves in the roots.
Mm-hmm. I mean, honeysuckle, is it always a bad thing to have? Can you trim it down and treat it like you know, other forms of landscaping? It's something that's going to be there, right? It's always going to be strong and healthy, I guess.
The bush honeysuckle is really one of the issues. It's not that it's honeysuckle; it's the specific species is invasive and it pushes out other natives. It does provide, you know, food for the birds and bees, but it's also not the same as providing as wide and varied nutrition for as some of the natives will do.
Right, and they encroach on the natives, so they're going to stay there, and then our natives that are giving the correct nutritional value that we want are no longer there, so that's the big deal.
Ben from Richmond, thank you for your call. Some very good questions. We're going to move on. This is Eastern Standard, 800-621-8890. If you'd like to get on the line, we have Alexis Amaris, Adam Leonberger, and Ryan Cook. Alexis and Adam are extension agents. Ryan is the director of Seedleaf in Lexington. And Ryan, not wanting to leave you out of the conversation, if you had any reaction to what we were just discussing here.
Yeah. You know, one thing I would just add for other listeners is I love not spraying my trees and stuff. We have a lot of kids coming through our gardens. Mm-hmm. So we've selected varieties that are naturally resistant, and we could not find an apple that was easy, let's say. So we've planted much more persimmons, pawpaws, hazelnuts, gooseberries, currants. Now, these are not things you see at the grocery store every day, but they're fun Kentucky natives, and they seem to do well with very little help from me.
All right, we're going to take another short break in just a minute, but this quick question from one of our listeners. If I have a compost pile, do I need to introduce live worms, or can I assume that there are some worms down there already ready to chow down on the compost pile?
No, they're definitely there. If it has ground contact, there's worms that'll find their way to it.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to have worms to compost. It's the microbes we're looking for, but worms are a great addition.
Worms and other little ground beetles and everything.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're talking about gardening and growing things, whether it's produce, things that we might eat, or vegetable, or fruit, or flowers. And we're interested in hearing from you with your questions, your comments, your personal stories, or your tips for other listeners. 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. Again, the phone number, 800-621-8890. And we'll be right back with more of Eastern Standard Live on this Thursday morning.
Gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling down.
Can you tell what is my favorite song about gardening? That is just the classic folk song. I don't know if it was written by Pete Seeger or the origins of that song. John Denver there, of course, and hopefully our listeners are recognizing that as a nice little ditty for this time of the year as we talk about gardening and growing things. We're interested in hearing from you with your questions, your comments, your personal stories, or your suggestions. 800-621-8890. The show is live on Thursday morning. If you tuned in on Sunday evening, sorry, you're too late to call in and be part of the conversation. But the folks who have called in or who have sent us an email are getting their questions answered by Alexis Amaris and Adam Leonberger, who are County Extension agents, and Ryan Cook, director of Lexington-based Seedleaf. Here's a question from Lee from Johnson County. Lee writes, since the hardiness zone has changed over the last 20 years, is there anything we can grow now that may have suffered before? So tell me about this hardiness zone. I don't think I've ever heard that term before.
Well, the USDA has a hardiness zone. It's based on the 20-year average, our minimum cold temperatures over the last 20 years. And it has kind of increased. We've increased in zone, so we've gotten warmer in the last few years. The ratings are pretty much kind of what that temperature, that plant can survive, what kind of winter area it can live in at that point.
Mm-hmm. And I think earlier in the show you had talked about, you know, Mother's Day was the day we said, you know, plant your tomatoes, you know, your warm season crops. And, you know, in my time, it's been more Derby Day. So Derby Day is, you know, the first week of May. So it's moved up by about a week. And, you know, we've had, you know, about 2-3 weeks of earlier spring this year.
This year I felt like it was St. Patrick's Day.
Right, yeah. I mean, and, you know, we did have some of those late frosts, so we did have people who put out things a little bit early and, you know, either had to protect their plants or they lost them. But, you know, for Central Kentucky, at least, I'm actually not quite sure where Johnson County is, but for Central Kentucky area, we say Derby Day is the day that you can plant all your warm summer, warm season crops out.
To what extent has our climate in Kentucky changed? We're obviously not going to start growing tropical fruits, oranges and grapefruits and all that, are we?
No.
No,
not even with a mild winter like we just had. So citrus is definitely more like a 60s is the low for most citrus.
Yeah, I'd say 50s maybe at the most.
Yeah.
It's not going to be able to tolerate freezing at that point.
But are there some things we're able to grow now that we couldn't 20 years ago?
I don't necessarily think that. I think we just have a longer growing season. So we're getting that extra 2 to 3 weeks of warm weather. We're getting longer season tomatoes. I don't really think that we have anything we can grow here now that we couldn't 20 years ago.
There's a few ornamental shrubs and stuff here and there, that perennials that might be able to move up, that maybe even, you know, you'd be able to find in Tennessee was Northern Range, and now we're the Northern Range now, but it's only a few of them. It's not really many crop
plants. Some of that comes down to breeding. They've bred, you know, the plants to be just 5 degrees more cold hardy, and that's where we're at. So
Ryan Cook of Seedleaf, talk about this climate change that we have experienced while we're talking about trying to source locally for the foods that we eat. Does this climate change make it easier for us to get quality food, or does it extend the range a little bit from where we can get food that is of high quality?
Well, I like the question. I think it's framed positively, like what stuff can we grow now? I'm also worried about new bugs and things that we didn't have to worry about formerly that are on their way. And can our extension agents speak to that? Are there any bugs coming that growers here should be thinking about?
The only one I'm thinking about right now is the Asian longhorn beetle, but that's not due to weather.
Most of the big insect diseases I know of right now that are moving this way are introductions and not really due to diseases. But you're right, as far as, you know, with that warming weather and, you know, longer growing season, it also means that this longer period and warmer, it's better conditions for those insects and diseases as well.
Right. So we're going to see populations boom more than new introductions. So we're going to see more sprays, more. And also, you know, the amount of rain we've been getting. We've been seeing these warmer temperatures and we've been seeing higher rain, which is, you know, prime pathology, prime fungal and bacterial instances there. Yeah.
I want to get back to the phone in just a moment, reminding our listeners that the number is 800-621-8890 if you'd like to be part of our live show on Thursday morning. But here's a note by email from Melody in Lexington. How about more on non-lethal control of critters? Melody says, I was frankly dismayed at the rather cavalier attitude exhibited toward the killing of wildlife. Folks may want to access the Humane Society of the U.S. website if they wish to live in harmony with our fellow earthlings.
Well, as far as like the moles and everything, unfortunately, it's a problem with some of those non-lethal ones, especially for people in urban areas. It's actually illegal and detrimental to the wildlife to trap and release them elsewhere. Like Alexis said, mm-hmm. the moles are very territorial. So if you trap them and pick them up live and try to take them someplace else, now they're in a new environment that they aren't familiar with. They're mm-hmm. not local area to that. And now they're competing with other moles in that area. You have the potential of spreading diseases along with that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I think, if you're wanting to live in harmony as far as, for example, deer. So Adam covered the mole section. But as far as the deer goes, put out a crop for the deer. I mean, I have people who love to watch the deer from their backyard, so they put out a little plot of corn that they allow the deer to be in, and they put up some fences, around the stuff that they would like to eat, and they leave that for the raccoons or the deer or even the coyotes. We have coyotes mm-hmm. that'll get into sweet corn. And so, that's something that these are for our farmers who make their living off of this and, buy a couple deer or coyotes destroying a crop. They've lost, the ability to feed their kids. And then as far as the moles, just stomp down the trails every day, and it'll be a fun game. And live with the moles, I guess, is another option. So,
yeah, living with it and dealing with it and just kind of learning to accept that there's going to be some livestock and wildlife around is definitely mm-hmm. always an option. Other options for the deer and wildlife is always electric fencing too.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing the animals, say the deer, a favor if you put something out for them to encourage them? And, are they not overpopulated?
Are we
creating other problems by being kind to a deer?
Sure. Well, that's what we have, hunting regulations that change every year. So the Department of Fish and Wildlife takes records of, what the populations are, and they will restrict hunters or allow hunters more of a, kill or whatever that is from year to year. So I think feeding the three deer that might be feeding on your corn is not going to affect the population too drastically. And then we have measures in place for that.
Okay, on a very remotely related topic, let's talk to Pat from Versailles. Pat, thank you for waiting on the line. You are on the air. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, Pat, you're on.
Hi. This is a kind of maybe an environmental question. My grandson was over yesterday, and it's kind of fun for like four-year-olds or in between to smush the ants because they're so easy to get to. And I was wanting to explain to him the importance of ants in the environment. Are they beneficial to, how can I explain that to him, I guess is my question. Mm-hmm. Or even are they?
They definitely are a benefit to the.
Yeah, so one way I could say would be, I love soil. So, right, soil is what we need to grow all of mm-hmm. our things. And any of your insects, they're going to be doing tunneling or moving, different products. Ants are known for picking things up and taking them other places. They'll increase, our soil and help our plants grow. That's kind of a really easy, simple way to explain to a grandkid is if you kill all the ants, then we might not be able to let our plants grow. Adam, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, from the four-year-old, that's a little bit more tricky, but they do also, they are major predators for the soil too, so they help to keep a lot of the little pests in check as well.
And we've heard a lot, and again, maybe peripherally related, we've heard a lot about the endangered honeybee.
Mm-hmm.
What's the situation there?
Honeybee?
That's an open-ended question.
I'm asking our guest. Yeah,
I know it is definitely an issue, and there's a lot of different things that are happening causing that decline in the population.
So some of that is loss of habitat. So you're looking at more and more farmland. Or I guess it's not was before not farmland, now being converted to farmland, so you lose loss of habitat. There's also, movement of the bees. If you might not realize, but bees are trucked cross-country sometimes to pollinate our citrus groves and our different apple and groves and things like that. So there is movement, and there is problems when you do that. And then our winters. I mean, as far as our local beekeepers, I'm only speaking about my Boyle County beekeepers in particular, but we've had a couple rough winters, and you would think that with the last winter that we had, where we had kind of a warmer winter, it would be better. But actually, when you think about it, the bees will kind of almost go into a hibernation state when it's cold. When it's warm and it's winter and there's nothing blooming, there's nothing for them to eat, so they starve. You know, they do have honey reserves, but sometimes when we have these warm winters, they run out of food. Our beekeepers do their best to feed them.
And it was a pretty dry fall, too, so the nectar flow was pretty awful this past
fall. So there wasn't quite as much honey for them to be put back there. So, you know, there's a lot of issues, and, you know, you can get into talking about the sprays and the pesticides and
diseases,
you know, but there's also diseases. There's so many different things that are kind of all coming to a head and having these effects.
We're talking about plants and growing things on this week's Eastern Standard. Our guests are Ryan Cook of Seedleaf. We have Adam Leonberger and Alexis Amaris, who are extension agents, and we have a few moments remaining. If you'd like to get on the line with a question, comment, or personal story at 800-621-8890. Pass along a couple more messages that we have received. I mean, John from Nicholasville didn't stay on the line, but his question was about how to get rid of Asian stink bugs. Not necessarily about growing things, but about back to tiny critters.
You got a vacuum?
Yeah.
If he's worried about them in his house, he needs to seal up his windows, seal up his doors, you know, the attic, things like that. That's really the only way to keep them out, and then vacuum them up when they're inside. They're here, and we're not getting rid of them anytime soon.
Robin emailed that says, Robin moved to Kentucky from Alaska and was looking forward to planting tasty tomatoes. Says, last year I had a plant, and just before my first harvest, something ate my beautiful ripe tomato.
Oh, no.
Thereafter, whatever it was, successfully ate all of my fruit. Any suggestions for protecting tomato plants?
Ryan, have you had any experience with this? I'm sure you have in that community garden.
With tomato plants, so we don't have any fences or gates or locks on almost all of our gardens. And we're doing our best to share with everybody. I know we share with critters sometimes, but we've been sharing with neighbors and children that stop by when we're not there. So, you know, the best thing I know to do is grow cherry and grape varieties because almost no person or animal wants to stick around and pick all of those. But they might take what they need right then, and then they'll move on.
Yeah. And if she's growing the big slicers, if you know, I love a good cherry tomato. But if you like a good slicer, and you're having those issues, it could be rabbits. Rabbits really like tomatoes. They'll come take a big old bite out of it. Deer, the same way that we were talking about earlier. You know, putting up deterrents. You know, making sure you're caging them, which will slightly deter them. You can have birds that affect them, so you might have to put up a net.
Even heard of their own dogs or the neighbor's dogs.
Yeah, yeah. So the key here is let's find out what is eating your tomatoes, and then we can help you figure out how to keep it from eating your tomatoes this year.
Is this a ridiculously naive question, but if something takes a bite out of a beautiful tomato, can you save the rest of it and share it?
I guess that depends who you ask.
Eat what's left?
That kind of comes down to how squeamish you are and how much you were. I would want to know what it was first, I think.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
you might not want to take a risk about catching something.
I wouldn't suggest it from a food safety standpoint. Mm-hmm. That's not food safety standpoint. I would say definitely no.
There's no 5 second rule.
No,
yeah,
the five second rule doesn't
no, not
there.
Really.
Yeah. Here's a question related to flowering plants, and this is what is a good type of low maintenance plant for my outside flower pots for Mother's Day? Are there any good places to get these plants at a reasonable cost in Franklin County?
Adam's looking at me, wanting me to answer this question.
You're the flower lady.
So a lot of this is going to be personal preference. I tend to stay away from the petunias and the portulaca, which are also the million bells, I'm sorry. They are in the tobacco family, and they require a lot of nitrogen. They want fertilized all the time. If you're looking for something low maintenance, grow a fountain grass. that's a good one. And or, you know, I don't I don't know what the size of your pots are, but I tend to like the salvias, the small zinnias. They're even making some dahlias now that are real short, very colorful, and they seem to do pretty well. So, but the salvias tend to be pretty good, and I know that our bees love them, so that's a positive thing. We're feeding our pollinators, and so it kind of depends on what your sweet potato vine does really well. If you want something that's trailing, I tend to like those, and if you have a shaded area, go with the fuchsia.
All right. And I know I'm seeing a couple of tweets here, Ryan, about issues of controlling insects in our garden. A comment that 80% of our insects in our garden are beneficial or benign. Do you have a comment about that?
I was wondering. A master gardener told me that once, and I wanted a fact check on that from our agents. Is that the case?
I don't know the exact number, but yeah, majority of them, as far as I know, are benign or not worth.
Right, they're
treating.
Just kind of hanging out, looking for a place in the shade, or they're going after some of those their predators, and they're going after the insects that we don't like. So that is true. We just notice the ones that are problems more because they're causing us problems.
We're just about out of time. Let me quickly get Larry on the line from Somerset and see if we can get a quick answer to Larry's. Question or comment. Larry, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon. I'm a biologist kind of by trade, and my question is, as there's warming of the climate, and if it's caused by carbon dioxide, is anyone considered the natural buffer that would occur by warming northern Canada and Siberia and lengthening those growing seasons, and just perhaps it's that Mother Nature has a plan to help buffer the system? I'll hang up and let you answer.
All right, Larry, thanks.
I don't know about buffer. I don't know if I'm gonna answer it in the right way, but there is this thing called carbon farming. So, you know, our plants naturally, we know the cycle, the photosynthesis, the plants take in the carbon dioxide. And so there is this idea now, and some people are doing this in areas called carbon farming, where basically they're planting trees, they're planting grasses that tend to take up more carbon dioxide than others. There are plants, there are certain trees that just take in more carbon than others. And then they return that to the soil instead of letting that go into the atmosphere. And in the soil, we can use it to grow more things. So there is this concept of carbon farming. And so maybe that is Mother Nature's version of a buffer in a way we can help Mother Nature buffer.
We are running out of time here. Very briefly, let me ask Alexis, Adam, and Ryan, each of you, to tell me where folks can go for information. How do they get answers to questions like this when you're not on the radio?
Yeah, so there is a county extension agent in every county in Kentucky. There are 120 offices. There's an agriculture agent in every single one of those offices. And if you're one of the lucky 30 counties, there is a horticulture agent in there. And that is where you can go, or University of Kentucky websites.
Mm-hmm. Just the UK dot.
You look it up, so you can put in apples UKY, and you'll pull up any scientific pub.
As I say, if you're not finding it there, you know, even just searching extension, whatever your topic is,
cooperative
extension or CES, that'll help come up with those items.
And Ryan Cook, regarding access to you, your organization, and your folks.
Oh yeah, we're at seedleaf.org, and we'd love to do any coaching we could with other folks doing small plots. Gardening in urban areas or just for home use.
All right, we are out of time. Thank you so much, Ryan Cook. Thank you, Adam Leonberger. Thank you, Alexis Amaris. Thanks to our listeners for being part of this week's Eastern Standard. Thanks to Devonna Gaines and Marissa Hempel for producing the show. Brian Bartlett has been at the controls. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for being with us for Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.